Julian, you did your best. It's freezing in Columbus. Did you ever make it west? Well, I was quiet. You were reckless, and the boys liked you better, and in truth I did mine. I was thunder to your lightning. You were flame, I was embers, and it scared me sometimes. And just being close to you, it felt like diving from the sky. You couldn't stem the bleeding, and neither could I. Juliet, you did your best. It's freezing in Columbus. Did you ever make it
WRCT Pittsburgh. No one is as excited about flaming cheese as we are.
Every year, over 1 million fires burn in America. Fortunately, firefighters are on the job, saving life and property, and you can be a part of it. 7 out of 10 firefighters and emergency responders are volunteers. There's no typical firefighter. Anyone can volunteer to serve their community. Volunteering as a first responder is really about having the heart and drive to make a difference where it's needed most. Your community needs you. Are you ready to answer the call? Learn more and find local volunteer opportunities at makemeafirefighter.org.
KIX Morning News Update. Mark's promise to rewrite rock history was prematurely and tragically interrupted last night when an overwhelming power surge totally destroyed Carnegie Hall and blacked out the entire city. Survivors describe the destruction as evil, spooky, and wow, bad karma, man. Our cameras are on the scene.
My name is Mark Mansabar. I know you love the flame of God. You've never seen the likes of me. Why, I'm the biggest thing since World War III, girl. My name is Mark, I'm on fire. I'm the match, and I'm the pyre. I'm the voodoo black musician priest. Why, I'm the greatest thing since World War III, girls.
You think he's acting, but he's not. His name is Mark, thanks a lot.
My name is Mark, thanks a lot. I'm the power Solomon used on lot. I am the poor, I am the snake, I'm the beat that makes you shake. I am the killer, I am the source, and you will worship me, of course. I'm the oracle, I'm the seer, the wit, there is no question that I am it. Hey girl,
thanks a lot, thanks a lot. He looks so cool, but he's hot.
My name is Mark, thanks a lot. My name is Mark.
listening to WRCT Pittsburgh's Radio Automation. Please stay tuned for more incredible tracks from our extensive, vast, libidinous, and...
balls.
Awesome. I called it libidinous. That doesn't make any... I mean...
All right, we are going to be talking today about the Pandora Papers, much requested segment. That'll be coming up. I want to start with Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp, because yesterday, Facebook and associated owned apps and platforms, WhatsApp and Instagram, suffered a complete and total outage, their worst in a very long time, just hours after a Facebook whistleblower was revealed and also made some very, very disturbing claims about Facebook's awareness about negative influence on people in society, but putting, according to the whistleblower, profit over society, profit over people. Now, are the two stories connected? Rampant speculation that the outage was deliberately put in place by Facebook to prevent those very platforms from being used to spread the claims of the whistleblower. The timing is definitely interesting for sure. There's no denying it. Although at this point in time, we don't have anything specific that would tell us that that's what went on. Some people are saying, David, what do you need? What do you need that's more specific? Let's look at the two stories sort of in tandem. First and foremost, Facebook whistleblower revealed on 60 Minutes says the company prioritized profit over public good. Would not come as a surprise to many people that that's what Facebook did, if indeed that is what the whistleblower observed. The identity of the Facebook whistleblower, who released tens of thousands of pages of internal research and documents leading to a firestorm for the social media company in recent weeks, was revealed on 60 Minutes Sunday night as Francis Haugen. The 37-year-old former Facebook product manager who worked on civic integrity issues at the company says the documents show that Facebook knows its platforms are used to spread hate, violence, and misinformation, and that the company has tried to hide that evidence. Reminds me of ExxonMobil knowing in the 70s the impact on the environment that their drilling activity had. Very similar vibes. The thing I saw at Facebook over and over again was there were conflicts of interest between what was good for the public and what was good for Facebook. And Facebook, over and over again, chose to optimize for its own interests, like making more money, Haugen told 60 Minutes. 60 Minutes correspondent Scott Pelley quoted one internal Facebook document as saying, quote, "We have evidence from a variety of sources that hate speech, divisive political speech, and misinformation on Facebook and the family of apps are affecting societies around the world." About a month ago, Haugen filed at least 8 complaints with the SEC, alleging the company is hiding research about its shortcomings from investors and the public. She shared the documents with The Wall Street Journal, which published a multi-part investigation showing Facebook was aware of problems with its apps, including the negative effects of misinformation and the harm caused especially to young girls by Instagram. If you're interested in that specifically, check out some of Jonathan Haidt's work on the effect of social media, not just on young people in general, but disproportionately on young girls, something he's worked on quite a bit. Haugen, who started at Facebook in 2019, is set to testify today before the Senate Subcommittee on Consumer Protection, Product Safety, and Data Security. I've seen a bunch of social networks, and it was substantially worse at Facebook than anything I've seen before. At some point in 21, I realized I'm going to have to do this in a systemic way, that I'm going to have to get out enough documents that no one can question this is real. Facebook has pushed back against reports claiming the claims are misleading and arguing its apps do more good than harm. So we're going to get back to that in a moment. Simultaneously, almost with the unveiling of this whistleblower, Facebook suffering its worst outage since 2008, pulling down Instagram, pulling down WhatsApp as well. Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp shut down for more than 6 hours on Monday. It marked the worst outage for the tech giant since 2008, when a bug knocked Facebook offline for about a day, but the service had only 80 million users back then. The outage was caused by, quote, configuration changes on the backbone routers, Facebook's VP of infrastructure, Santosh Janardhan, said in a blog post late Monday. As of the writing of this article, some of the services are not yet fully functioning. For example, some users are still reporting problems posting new content to Instagram. All three platforms stopped working shortly before noon when websites and apps for Facebook services were responding with server errors. Reports on downdetector.com showed the outages appeared to be widespread. Okay, so a bunch of interesting things here. The first thing is, again, are these two stories connected? Is this a lie? Is Facebook just straight up lying? And they pulled down access to their platforms specifically to prevent the spread of the information about the whistleblower. I don't know. I mean, you know, this is one of those things where there are people who will say, obviously not. That's obviously not what happened. Others who will say, of course, that's what happened. This is an outage of this degree is so rare that the idea that it would just be a coincidence is essentially impossible. And then people with opinions in between. I don't know. All I can tell you is the timing is interesting. Now, what was more interesting is that I missed nothing from these platforms being down. And what I mean by that is, okay, I was working. I don't really do Facebook during the day. It didn't affect me negatively in any way that Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp were down for this period of time. Now, maybe if it had been a Saturday when I might just be chatting with people on some of these platforms, maybe it would have been different. It did affect our team. We upload content to these platforms. We were unable to do so. It kind of threw for a loop our entire day. But it is very interesting to get perspective sometimes on the importance we believe that these apps have and then what they really have when they are missing. Now, WhatsApp is relied upon in many countries as the default messaging app. And I am on a bunch of WhatsApp threads with people in other countries, Argentina and elsewhere. Obviously, those weren't working. I'm not using that to communicate things of paramount importance. Many people are, and it affected them significantly. Now, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is using what happened yesterday as an opportunity to say, break these companies up. There's no reason WhatsApp should have to be down because Facebook's down, other than Facebook bought WhatsApp because it saw WhatsApp as a competitor. We will deal with that on the bonus show. But in the meantime, let me know your thoughts. Do you see the outage and the whistleblower unveiling as connected or merely coincidental? Now I want to get to some absolutely mind-blowing audio. This is like an example of some of the worst of corporate response to a crisis. NPR's Ari Shapiro interviewed Neil Potts, Facebook's VP for Trust and Security, yesterday about these documents leaked by the whistleblower that was exposed on 60 Minutes or unveiled on 60 Minutes. The interview is fascinating because Neil Potts doesn't really deny any of the claims, doesn't really deny any of the substance of what the whistleblower alleges, but instead seems just sort of shaken, almost like he didn't expect these were the questions that were going to be asked. He deflects using odd language. This is sort of a clinic in how not to do crisis management. So let's just jump right in and listen here.
And Facebook over and over again chose to optimize for its own interests, like making more money.
We'll note that the company is among NPR's financial supporters. And we're joined now by Facebook executive Neil Potts. He is vice president for trust and safety. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Buckle up here.
Hey, Ari, how are you? Neil Potts, thank you.
All right, good to have you here. So how can I explain Facebook's calculus this way? If the company changed the algorithm to make people safer and deprioritized hateful and divisive posts, then people would spend less time on the site, click on fewer ads, the company would make less money. Do you agree that polarization leads to engagement, which translates to money for Facebook?
So the argument here, it's important to understand, and I'm not going to keep interjecting, but the idea here is, although Facebook publicly says we want to depolarize, we want to remove disinformation, internally they know that that stuff generates clicks, which means money. So that in reality, they say one thing publicly, but they encourage this stuff on the platform.
To money for Facebook.
I think I'll categorically deny that. I think that accusation is just a bit unfounded. At Facebook, what we are designing our products to do is to increase meaningful experiences. So whether those are meaningful social interactions, I think that is the change that the leaker mentions in her 60 Minutes interview. or having just positive social experience on the platform, that is what we want the products ultimately to provide.
Now, it's not unfounded in that there are thousands of documents that the leaker provided which show the opposite of what Neil Potts is saying.
It's an environment where people will come to Facebook, where they will come to Instagram and have a better time. And that's really our bottom line.
So I just want to be clear. Are you saying it may be the case that polarization leads to more engagement, but we're not trying to polarize our users, so that's not what we want the algorithm to do? Or are you saying, no, the premise that more extreme views will lead people to engage more is just fundamentally wrong?
I think just taking a step back on that question of polarization, I think polarization has, existed long before Facebook.
So that's a deflection, okay? The question's really specific. And Neil Potts says, we didn't create polarization. That wasn't the question, Neil.
This long after, perhaps we're all no longer here. That being said, at Facebook, we're not designing anything to be for the sensational or clickbaity or engagement-baity ways that polarization may be seen. And that, I think, was being accused of Facebook and the leadership.
The guy's making absolutely no sense. I mean, he just seems completely unprepared for what were obviously going to be the questions.
On the product. Our products are designed to have more meaningful social interactions, those interactions with your friends, your loved ones,
what does that mean?
Close-knit groups, to ensure that you're coming to the platform to have a positive social experience, one that you can have not only just meaningful experiences, but things that you will find perhaps unfettered positive values in.
You guys, I hope everybody realizes this guy's making no sense and answering none of the questions.
Specifically about some of the safeguards that were put in place after or in the run-up to the 2020 election, these were to reduce misinformation. And Haugen says many of those protections went away after the election. We now see indictments against some of the January 6th rioters that cite Facebook posts. So how does Facebook defend its decision to dissolve its civic integrity unit now that you know what happened just after the election when some of those safeguards were no longer in place?
Beautiful.
Thanks, Ari. I think I want to make sure that we're very clear here that the civic integrity unit has not been dissolved in any ways. Actually, it has been in many ways promoted throughout the company. The team is now sitting with other teams so that we can take lessons learned.
So this was a centralized team, and now its individual responsibilities have been farmed out to other teams.
It's still within our centralized integrity.
I don't know that this guy says one thing that we can actually take away that's substantive.
The broader team to focus on other issues, including civic integrity, but also issues that...
So it's like what he's saying is the team we had has not actually been disbanded. It's just been broken up, and they're now distributed and working on different issues. Well, so you've disbanded it, right? The people have been separated and they're working on different issues and maybe also this one issue.
Issues that are, I think, at the top of everyone's mind, including issues around health and COVID-19. You can see a lot of the similarities between the way that we've treated elections on the platform with our elections hub, as well as what we are doing around COVID-19 and the COVID-19 hub. So those teams are still in practice, doing work and actually working on civic issues and elections.
The teams are still in practice doing work.
Let me turn to Instagram and how it affects young people. Here's how Haugen characterized the company's research last night on 60 Minutes.
Facebook's own research says it is not just that Instagram is dangerous for teenagers, that it harms teenagers. It's that it is distinctly worse than other forms of social media.
And she says that research found 13.5% of teen girls said Instagram makes thoughts of suicide worse. 17% said it worsened eating disorders. And when Congress asked about this, CEO Mark Zuckerberg misstated the company's research and then withheld the damaging information that came out in this leak. How does Facebook justify that?
I think Mark withheld any of the research. I think one of the issues here, we're very committed to doing research. We recognize the value so we can close the gaps or reduce the gaps. But I want to put a bit of the context of this research into field as well.
It just goes absolutely. We're committed to doing research to close gaps. Yeah, but that's not what the question was about.
This research was done for boys and girls of teenage years, over 12 different areas. And the majority of respondents here, both boys and girls, said that Facebook and Instagram have a net positive on their
Okay. And of course, that's also a deflection because the point is, many things for most people aren't negative, but if something is negative for a lot of people, it still matters and it's still important. So Neil Potts, not prepared, answering nothing of substance, and we're going to continue to follow what the fallout is from this, both from the outage and from the whistleblower. I want to remind you, Tuesday, October 19th at 6 p.m. Eastern, we'll be doing a David Pakman Show live town hall. It will be exclusively streamed on the new David Pakman Show YouTube channel, Pakman Live, which you can find at youtube.com/Pakman Live. Get subscribed there in advance of the live town hall. Find me on Twitter. Let me know what you think about this Facebook stuff. I'm at D Pakman on Twitter. Many of you have been emailing me about the Pandora Papers, and I want to start and do sort of like a brief overview of what the Pandora Papers are and kind of show you how I would go through learning about what is here. Now, one completely reasonable way to start would be go directly to the source material, which we're going to do. I'm actually, for this particular segment, I'm going to start with the wiki article about the Pandora Papers. Now, a lot of people will say, David, anybody can edit Wikipedia. It's not actually a source. And Wikipedia would admit that. Wikipedia, you have to source the things that are there. Although there are inaccuracies in Wikipedia, in this particular article, I actually think that it's a good place to start to get an overview of what this is about. Then we go to primary sources. Then we go to articles about it. So what are the Pandora Papers? The Pandora Papers are 11.9 million leaked documents that were published by the ICIJ, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, starting on October 3rd, 2 days ago. The leak exposed the secret offshore accounts of 35 world leaders, including current and former presidents, prime ministers, and heads of state, as well as more than 100 billionaires, celebrities, and business leaders. The news organizations of the ICIJ described the document leak as their most expansive expose of financial secrecy yet, containing documents, images, emails, and spreadsheets from 14 financial service companies in nations including Panama, Switzerland, and the Arab Emirates, surpassing their previous release of the Panama Papers in 2016. At the time of the release of the papers, the ICIJ said it is not identifying its source. Up to an estimated $32 trillion U.S. dollars, excluding non-monetary valuables such as real estate, art, and jewelry, may be hidden from being taxed, according to news reports. Now, just to hear, there are 12 different citations that we could look at. Okay? The next part is about disclosures. There's a sub-article, a list of people named in the Pandora Papers, which you can look at separately. It lists heads of state, and it goes from the King of Jordan, Abdullah II, through, you know, the Chilean president, the Kenyan president. It includes former heads of state as well, heads of government, including Patrick Achi, the prime minister of Cote d'Ivoire, and many others. Heads of organizations, ministers, bankers, some of these individual names will be meaningful to people, some less so. Royalty, including the former King of Spain, Juan Carlos, business people, on and on and on. So we now have sort of like an initial understanding of what this is. These are disclosures about the financial holdings, assets, and accounts of important or elite individuals. Where do we go next? Next, we go to the actual disclosures on the website of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. This is filled with various articles and different documents. Many of these start to be sort of commentaries on the Pandora Papers. But one thing you can go to is the key findings section from the organization that put this together itself. The key findings are, and again, we're building our understanding of what this is. An investigation by more than 600 journalists from 150 news outlets has unearthed offshore dealings of 35 current and former world leaders and more than 300 other current and former public officials and politicians. The offshore system continues to thrive despite decades of legislation, investigations, and international agreements aimed at combating money laundering and tax dodging. South Dakota and more than a dozen U.S. states have become leaders in the business of selling financial secrecy, even as the U.S. blames smaller nations for enabling tax avoidance and dirty money flows. That's important. You know, very often it's believed that if you want to do tax avoidance and shield assets, you go to the Caribbean, you go to Switzerland, etc. But actually, South Dakota and some other states have become really nexuses or nexi in this apparatus. The Pandora Papers unmask the hidden owners of offshore companies, secret bank accounts, private jets, yachts, mansions, and artworks by Picasso, Banksy, and other masters. The biggest leak in ICIJ history contains almost 3 terabytes of information from 14 offshore service providers. So then you could go and look at the actual data if you wanted. This is another part of the website, which at this immediate moment is not loading. Once we've done this, then you can certainly look at other commentaries and summations of the Pandora Papers. So, for example, BBC has put out a guide to the leak that focuses on the UK, right? The owners of more than 1,500 UK properties bought using offshore firms. The Qatari ruling family, who avoided £18.5 million tax on a London super mansion. The prominent Tory donor involved in a European corruption scandal. And it goes on and on from there. So this is how I would get myself informed. And obviously, I would probably spend an hour looking at this stuff. We're not going to do an hour because that would be the whole show. But that's how I would start. Take a glance at the wiki to understand what this is generally about. Look at those citations, go to the primary reporting, and then expand into commentaries about the social implications, the cultural implications, the economic implications. We'll dive deeper on specific aspects of this over the coming week, but that can serve as a sort of initial introduction to what these leaks are. I want to talk about, in all seriousness, this is sort of one of the better interviews I've seen with Donald Trump. Thanks to the interviewer, Adam Shapiro from Yahoo Finance, not a guy I was familiar with that at least I remember ahead of this interview. Adam Shapiro did a 22-minute long interview with Donald Trump. It's absolutely horrifying for Donald Trump. But Adam Shapiro actually makes a real attempt to get Trump to answer the questions that he's asking and to insist by asking again when Trump goes elsewhere. It's still unhinged Trump, but Adam Shapiro was actually able to sort of get Trump to weigh in on certain things. Let's start with a clip. The topic is 2024. How and when would Trump decide? What does he think about the possible challenge that he faces from Ron DeSantis, the sort of Trumpian to the extreme governor of Florida? A lot of different questions here. Let's just jump right into it.
So, Mr. Trump, when you consider what it's going to take for you to decide if you're going to run for president, this would be one of the issues. Curious, though.
This would be one who just agrees with competency.
One of many issues, I would imagine. But you'd have to win the nomination
again. Now, by the way, Trump already just talking over Adam Shapiro, not even letting him get to the question. It's typical Trump, but Adam Shapiro really does a pretty good job here.
I'm curious, how would you...
I'll give you a couple of others. Well, economy, inflation.
If you faced a Republican like Ron DeSantis in the primaries, what would it take for you to beat him?
Yeah.
Well, number one, I don't think I will face him because I don't see that if I did it. I don't see that. I think most people would drop out. I think he would drop out. And if I faced him, I'd beat him like I would beat everyone else, frankly.
So this is interesting because Trump is saying he believes if he ran, a lot of people would drop out, either out of respect to Trump or for whatever. That's interesting to hear.
And you take a look at what's going on in the polls, where I have way over 90% and in some cases 98% approval rating of the Republican Party because I did a great job as president, despite all of the hoaxes, despite the Russia, Russia, Russia.
Now, it's not completely true what Trump is saying. Trump is dominating the primary field for 2024. But his approval is less relevant than the number who say they would vote for him to be the nominee. And that's about 58%. It's a high number. It's still the highest number anybody else has. But it is not, you know, Trump by saying 90% or whatever is acting like he would get 90% of the primary vote. He may well have 80 or 90% approval, though he never really cites sources. He's polling in between 50 and 60 in terms of the actual primary.
That now has been exposed as a total fraud. Despite everything, we did a great job. Largest tax cuts in history, rebuilt the military, Space Force, took care of our vets. 92% approval rating in the VA for the first time ever, way higher than ever before. You know, we did a job that nobody's done, and had COVID not come and interrupted, we had the greatest economy. Again, say what you want, we had 160 million jobs. Our country was never close to that.
Now, of course, we've talked before about the labor participation rate sort of hoaxes. The population of the U.S. grows, and so most of the time we have more people working than ever before or close to it, and more people not working than ever before or close to it. That's just a political game that they play.
Mr. Trump, it's not what I want. It's just the jobs created during your administration. I think that it's the Bureau of Labor Statistics points out it was something like 6.4 million jobs. And during the Obama administration, it was 7 million jobs. But when I hear what you're saying about the need for perhaps you to run in 2024, what I'm hearing you say is you are going to run. Are you?
No, I haven't. I haven't said that. I said that if I do run, I think that I'll do extremely well. And I'm looking not only at polls, I'm looking at the enthusiasm. We did a great job. Now, when you say what you had just said, the economy, as you know, was very bad when he took over. So the economy wasn't terrible when I took over, but it wasn't great. It was stagnant and slow. I guess it was the worst recovery since the Depression of 1930.
Okay, so Trump getting into his very strange and random kind of historical claims. But the truth is, the economy was generally good under Trump until COVID hit. There was job creation under Trump, but the rate of job creation diminished compared to under Obama. And Trump got lower job creation with a significantly higher deficit. So we can analyze that for what it is, but let's make sure we're actually analyzing the real data. Next, Trump goes on to, Adam Shapiro moves on to Steve Bannon, where there seems to be a disagreement. Bannon says he talks to Trump regularly. Trump's like, no, I don't talk to the guy. I haven't talked to him for a long time.
Mr. Trump, there's one last question I want to ask you as we wrap, and it's because I covered your administration for the first year and a half. I was in Washington, and I remember that Steve Bannon lost your trust when he spoke to Michael Wolff for that
right.
book, and he left the administration. But he's re-earned your trust, and I'm curious what he did to get back into your good graces and to get your trust.
Yes.
Well, Steve didn't get along with certain people in the administration, so I understand that that happens, and it happens with all administrations, frankly. And for a period of time, he just didn't do it, and I understand that. But if you look at Steve over the last 3 years, he sees what a great job we've done as an administration. When you look at all of the things that I've enumerated, plus many others, I mean, a thing like...
No, this is not an answer to the question, notice, but eventually Adam Shapiro jumps in with what is the real question.
Where you can get medical treatment of something experimental if you're in bad shape. If
but
you're
Mr.
terminal
Bannon, was
or in
it,
bad
he was
shape.
Advising you towards so the end things. Of your administration?
Excuse me?
Mr. Bannon was advising you towards the end of the administration?
No, not at all. No, I haven't spoken to Steve almost at all. No, he wasn't. But I know that he's got a show that's very successful.
He says he does. So is he lying when he says he was talking to you in the last months of your administration?
Very little. We would speak very little. Now, Steve and I spoke very little, but I will tell you he was very supportive.
So someone is lying, certainly. But now Trump backing off by saying we spoke very little, which makes it, you know, maybe mildly plausible. One last clip. Here's Donald Trump asked about cryptocurrency. It's just kind of interesting.
Now, a great many of our viewers here on the Yahoo Finance platform are into cryptocurrencies. And the well-known Bitcoin investor, Anthony Pompliano, was just on my program talking about China's crackdown on crypto. He says that's a big gain for the United States. You have a relationship with the Chinese president, Xi Jinping. What do you think Xi Jinping is up to? And is this crackdown on crypto good for the U.S.?
Well, I think he wants to do his own currency, whether it's crypto or otherwise. And one of the reasons that we have to be very careful is we have a currency right now, the dollar. And I'm a big fan of the dollar. I'm a big fan of our currency. And I don't want to have other currencies coming out and hurting or demeaning the dollar in any way. And China's looking to do... China's certainly not looking to back the dollar, but right now they're based on the dollar, and they would probably have to stay that way unless we do something very foolish in our country.
So the takeaway here is Trump really doesn't know what he's talking about. But I liked the interview in that the interviewer prevented Trump from going totally off the rails. He kept Trump focused enough where you could tell Trump doesn't really understand these issues in any kind of serious way. Very overall, very nice job there by Adam Shapiro on Yahoo Finance. That interview not getting a lot of views at all. Some of those clips only have 5,000 views on the Yahoo Finance channel, worth looking at in total. We'll have more clips on the show's Instagram at David Pakman Show. Find us there. Today, I am joined by James Cromwell, actor, activist, producer, whose new film, Mondo Hollywoodland, follows a politically confused mushrooms dealer who traverses through Hollywood, available now on Amazon Prime Video. James, so great to have you on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
So talk to us a little bit about this film, which you produced. What was the genesis of the idea here?
The genesis of the idea was that maybe it made him easier for him to sell the film. So
I love the honesty. I love it. Which matters a lot. It's not a small issue.
No, it is not. Not if you want your film to be seen.
Can you talk a little bit about the 60s era Mondo films that this movie is sort of an homage to? And sort of what you see as interesting about the genre.
Well, I think if I have my genres right, it's a Nouvelle Vague. It's Godard and Chabrol and Varda and Truffaut, the New Wave, they called it. I think of this film sort of as the Bout de Souffle, which is Godard's film, only in color. There are stories that Godard actually knew that what he was doing was bad, but that was the whole point. So he was trying to look at the language of film and develop a new syntax, a new way of making films, sort of the way Bertolt Brecht does with what he's called Verfremdungseffekt, which mm-hmm. is to distance an audience, to keep them aware that it is filmic, that it is a film, it is a fiction, it is a narrative. It relates to something that is up for the audience to create for themselves.
In hearing you talk in this way about films, I'm realizing, and I wonder if you agree, that this type of analysis of film has become sorely lacking sort of in popular culture in the United States at this point in time. Do you agree with that? I mean, it seems to me that the richness of the discussion of film in this style is not what it once was in popular society.
Certainly in America.
Yeah.
Because in America, film is considered a product. A studio has a certain a studio works is owned by a corporation. That corporation has obligations to its shareholder to produce a profit. They produce this thing called a film, cinema. They show the cinema and they try to reach as broad an audience as possible. So they either play down to that audience or through the media that they also control, they create reviews that make the thing seem as vacuous as possible.
Right.
So as not to offend anybody before they're sitting in the seats watching it.
So there's two layers. In other words, the film is created in a certain way, but the discussion of that film in its promotion could still be more substantive. But even that, in order to make the film appealing, is kept relatively superficial. So you really have two layers of this that you're fighting against.
Yeah. If you think of a film like Joker and you think, well, are they going to take that film seriously? Some people, which I'm really glad, were offended by that film. But there's a lot to unpack in that film. There's a lot of discussions about who we are, where we are, what we're doing. Are we insane? Who runs the show? What can we do as individuals to oppose it? What is the cost of living in a dysfunctional society when your entire mental structure is cobbed together from falsehood?
Mm. I remember watching an interview where Charlie Rose interviewed the late David Foster Wallace. And they were just chatting about different things. And Charlie Rose asks David Foster Wallace his opinion about The English Patient. And after sort of in that David Foster Wallace sense of saying, you really care what I think about The English Patient? Is that real? Are you really asking me that? He says, I think it's a beautifully filmed, commercial Hollywood endeavor. That was sort of like his top line analysis, that fundamentally it's still, it looks nice, but it's a profit-driven Hollywood endeavor. Is your top line analysis of a film similar, where first you're looking at what was the point of the production here? Was it an independent project? Was it a profit-driven project, Hollywood, et cetera?
That enters into my thinking. Also the way that certain, what would I call them? Not metaphors, but when they use contemporary situations, circumstances, events that really happened, or real people, exploitatively, without examining what they're doing. They just use it because it gives a patina of reality, of pertinence. I think it's a great mistake. People do that with the Holocaust. They do that with the Nazis. They do that in a variety of ways. The politics are always, what it comes down to is it's basically a boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl.
Hmm.
But so a film like Syriana, which has many, 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 many layers,
yeah,
and is very provocative if you think about it, gets short shrift because they know, the powers that be, is that an audience is not going to be able to analyze that film from an understanding of what the reality is. So they'll miss half the film and say, what was that all for? I don't understand. I like George Clooney. He's so funny. Why can't he do... And you think, wow, that's a waste.
It's so interesting that you mentioned that movie, because that's one that I've thought about in this context, where when you look at the analysis and the discussion of it, it's talking about 20 or 30% of the film. And like you're pointing out, there's so much substance there that seems to be above the radar in a sense, or below. I don't know.
Yeah, I agree.
When it comes to, you mentioned the Holocaust, for example, as one topic sometimes that's touched in certain ways and not others. I just finished up reading the book Technopoly by the critic Neil Postman, where he talks about, in the education context in the United States, and this book was written in 1992, but still relevant, there's often agreement about what are valuable topics in school. And the Holocaust is one that is considered, we teach about the Holocaust, we teach about slavery, etc. Similarly, in literature, there are often books or authors where there's a sort of consensus, like it's important that students read this. But less commonly, is there really thought given to what is it that we want people to learn, and then how should they use this in their lives going forward? Like, what's the point? What do we want people to take away from learning about the Holocaust or whatever the case may be? Is that applicable to film as well, when some of these events or ideas are used just to make a movie, excuse me?
Yes, I think it is. I did a film called The Panama Papers. I think mm-hmm. it was called The Panama Papers. And it was interesting because the Panama Papers revelations, it seemed to exclude every American. There was no American mentioned. Mm. And there's no real connection to an event in America, but it was it wasn't central to what the story was about, which was how this catastrophe occurred. And I'm noticing the same things in this new revelation, the Pandora Papers, that it's all about Kenyatta of Kenya and somebody in Czechoslovakia and all these people. Then they say, and celebrities. And I don't know what that consortium of independent journalists thought was happening with people who have a great deal of money, because that's what they do. They make very clear that there's no criminality involved. But at the same time, they don't show you the whole story, which is two of our states, Delaware and South Dakota, are probably two of the biggest offshore deposits of people's money that there are.
Yeah.
So in other words, in almost any time, film is a very simple medium. If you overlay it with a lot of fact, if there's a lot of levels to understanding, it's very hard to keep an audience, because an audience is only interested not only in the narrative, but seeing themselves in the character so that they can experience the thing that the things that the character does, and they play this sort of game isolated by themselves. Whereas you get a film like The Battle of Algiers, which I saw back in the 60s in a movie house in New York, and there were Black Panthers in the front row, right in front of me. And of course, they understood every nuance of that film because they'd seen it in their community. But I, a nice white boy sitting behind him, I'm looking at this film, it's revelatory, but I know nothing about how the police, how the state operates in a ghetto to suppress the aspirations of the people.
Right. A couple things I wanted to ask about, maybe related to this. You've been arrested several times doing activism. It's typically like trespassing, basic civil disobedience. Does that have any long-term impact in any kind of legal sense? Do those arrests matter? Because they're not, they don't rise to the level, interestingly enough, of where you start falling subject to like a three strikes and you're out sort of thing. Does it have any impact at all on you?
Well, actually it does in Texas.
Ah.
The one I have in Texas, I'm still on probation.
Wow.
really means that I cannot get arrested in any state for breaking any law. And you know, it, if I had a larger, a career, I suppose that I would be like, some wonderful people in Hollywood who actually do really great work.
Mm.
I'm not sure that Sean Penn gets the opportunities to do the work now that he did before because of the work that he did in Haiti and the enemies that he made in Haiti, namely the Clinton Foundation and the United Nations, and what he saw and how he reacted to it and how he spoke about it. So I don't know. My activism, I don't think, rises to that level. But people do notice. It is a valid it is a technique of civil disobedience, breaking the law in order to bring attention to the law, to crimes that are being committed inside of the law. Will there be ramifications to my career? There may be, but I can't stop it. I have to continue doing what I'm doing.
No doubt. Were a Bernie supporter. Are you, what's your sense so far of Joe Biden's presidency?
How many Haitians has he sent back? What's he doing at the border?
Mm-hmm.
This was the same with Obama. Obama had both houses of Congress. He had the presidency. He did absolutely squat.
Mm.
I don't think much changes between that administration and what it managed to accomplish until it got into the sort of stalemate that's going to exist in 2022 when the Republicans take back the House. We're going to be in the same bloody position. The change, as Thunberry says and other young environmentalists say, it's not going to come from the blah, blah, blah of politicians. It's going to come from the street. It's going to come from the demands of people. I think that will happen.
So you don't think too highly so far of what Joe Biden has done. Clearly, do you distinguish between, is there a consequence to the fact that it's Joe Biden and not another 4 years of Trump?
It's not another 4 years of Trump, but we all in the 60s, we also say, yeah, but it's so much like it under the surface. I mean, when you watch the policies. What's happening around the world? When are we going to start? It looks like we're trying to start a war with China. But what's going to happen around the world to this war state that we have created to satisfy the needs of the military-industrial complex? We need those wars. We need those bases. I just watched a film on the F-35. The development of the F-35 is going to cost over $1 trillion, between $1 and $1.7 trillion. They're being sold at $180 million a piece. What are we doing as we head towards the precipice of environmental destruction? What are we doing supporting this industry, those industries, and the extraction industries? So he just opened up a whole new drilling thing off the coast off the West Coast after they had that oil spill caused by a ship dragging its anchor and puncturing a pipe.
Yeah.
There's no way to have this system, and I by that, this system, I mean capitalism, and have a democratic solution to the problems that all the problems that ail us, the environment, racism, sexism, the across the lot. Nothing is going to change as long as people put profit ahead of people.
Do you see the systems in places like Denmark, Norway, and Sweden as sufficiently different, or is that not enough?
No, I think it's sufficiently different. It's not enough. It needs to be reexamined. However, if we had the system of the Scandinavian countries, we could at least have a dialogue about what's happening in this country.
Right.
What's happening to the people who feel so disaffected that they attack the Congress of the United States violently to achieve what? Their lives were not appreciably made better by that man's presidency. No. So what are they thinking? Are they thinking, or are they being led by an Australian named Murdoch to not be able to distinguish the truth from falsehood when it's right in their faces and it's them?
Yeah.
He's the worst.
He's up there for sure. He is up there for sure. Yeah. We've been speaking with actor and activist James Cromwell. The new film is Mondo Hollywoodland. James, I so appreciate being able to speak with you. The film is now available on Amazon Prime Video, and we're linking to it. Really a pleasure speaking with you today.
Likewise. Enjoy the film. It's really a wonderful film. See it.
We have major controversial vaccine news from the state of California, which has announced that California will require eligible students in public and private schools to be vaccinated against COVID-19. Now, the real headline should be, California will require eligible students in public and private schools to be vaccinated against COVID-19 in addition to all the other vaccines that California students in public and private schools already have to be vaccinated against. Because that's really what this is. California already has a long list of requirements, and importantly, they apply to private schools as well. Looking at an article from ABC7, California will soon require all students in both public and private schools to get the COVID vaccine once it's authorized by the FDA for different age groups. Gavin Newsom announced the emergency order Friday while visiting a middle school in San Francisco. The COVID vaccine will now join a list of 10 other vaccinations required for children to attend school in the state. The governor said the state will issue the mandate in the next school term following the FDA's approval, the earliest being January 1, 2022, and the latest being July 1 of 2022. The government has fully approved the vaccine for those 16 plus, but only emergency use for 12 to 15. Once that group is fully approved, the state will require students in 7th through 12th grades to get vaccinated. California will require it for students in kindergarten through 6th grade after that approval takes place. At the same time, staff members at all state schools will need to be fully vaccinated. The state issued a mandate in August for teachers and school staff. Now it has eliminated the option to do regular testing instead of getting the vaccine. You just got to get the vaccine. Students would be granted religious and medical exemptions, but the rules for how to the state would apply them have not yet been written. Any student who refuses to take the vaccine will be forced to do independent study courses at home. Very important. In California, it also applies to charter schools, and it also applies to private schools. Charter and private schools are held to the same standards and same curriculum requirements, and it applies to vaccines as well. That's not the case in all states. That's how California is organized. California already requires 10 vaccines to go to school. There are some anti-vaxxers who complain about that, but not many. So this is relatively uncontroversial. And once you understand existing California law with regard to vaccination and exemptions, California has also really tamped down on religious exemptions for vaccinations. Medical is one thing, but religious, they've very much tamped down on. You realize that there is really not much controversy here relative to the existing California law. Now, if you live in a state that has completely different laws, what's happening in California might sound shocking. It still shouldn't be. It might be very much incongruous with what's happening in your state. But for California law, completely normal, expected, and we're going to be hearing more about it very soon. I have an example for you today of totally backwards morality and bankrupt principles. They're not even really principles, quite frankly. Fox News anchor Martha McCallum bemoaned a free lunch program in New Jersey, saying there are kids who might grow up thinking school lunch is actually free. Can you guys imagine? Can you imagine if a kid grew up thinking school lunch is free? It would be terrible for them, everybody, I guess. Let's listen to Martha McCallum. This is like the worst of the worst of this strict father morality ideology that we hear espoused by some on the right and certainly on Fox News. Listen to this.
One of the things that kills me is that now that, you know, there's a free lunch program in New Jersey, and it's for everyone, even if you don't need help to send your child's lunch to school. So those kids are all going to grow up thinking, well, school is lunch is free, right? And then God help the person who comes along and tries to take that away, Larry. You talk about free lunch. I mean, that will never, once that happens, right, but once it's baked in there, it's never going to
happen. But it's important what you said. You're going to pay for it with higher taxes and higher inflation. And I think most, again, common sense Americans know this is not right. They don't want big government socialism. They don't want a welfare state.
Can you imagine? So, first of all, Martha seems sympathetic to whoever's going to try to stop the free school lunch. Now, there's a couple different things here. How is it that we have public education paid for through taxes? It's like prepaid in a sense. It's not free. It's prepaid. Public education, but not the lunch. You add the lunch and now it's socialism. Idiotic. I mean, the level on which these people operate is absolutely pathetic. But why shouldn't school lunch be free? And again, in a literal sense, the food's not free, but people pay property taxes to fund schools. People pay property taxes for a lot of things. There are some parts of the country, it's municipality based. In some parts of the country, your property taxes include trash and recycling pickup. It's part of your property taxes. We don't say it's free. We say it's prepaid through property taxes. In some parts of the country, I have relatives who live in municipalities where property taxes don't include trash pickup. You've got to do your property taxes and then you've got to hire someone, you know, could be $30 a month, whatever, to do your trash pickup and your recycling pickup. In neither case is anything free. Sometimes it's just included. Sometimes property taxes pay for good schools. Sometimes the property taxes people pay for not so good schools. If property taxes cover school lunch, what's the big realization that's going to be devastating for kids? Just, the property taxes cover school lunch. Also, school is mandatory. You have to be there, but they don't have to give you food at no additional cost. Remember, it's not free. It's paid for through property taxes. It's not free at point of purchase to have food when you're obligated to be in school. There are kids who are depending on school in order to eat, by the way. I think it's important to mention. Is it a good thing for kids to be thinking that whether or not they have food that day depends on all of this other stuff other than just, did you come to school today? Great. You get lunch. And remember, it's not really free. It's prepaid. That to be accurate, it's prepaid through property taxes. My mom didn't charge me for lunch at home, but I didn't think it was free. I realized she bought the food. My dad bought the food, right? Imagine thinking that so-called free school lunch is the problem and not the financially and not the fact that huge corporations sometimes pay zero taxes despite profiting handsomely. Just such a backwards world and the disdain. The indignant Martha McCallum. Can you imagine? God help, she says. God help kids who think they grow up thinking that school lunch is free. This is a huge part of the problem ideologically in this country, where we end up having to put energy and time into these debates when we could all just agree like, hey, school lunch being prepaid through property taxes, it's no big deal. Let's focus on something better. Let's improve education. And by the way, if you're hungry at school, you're not going to learn. You're not going to learn. So there's a number of different ways in which this just makes absolutely perfect sense. We have a voicemail number, which is 219-2-DAVID-P. You can call anytime if you have a message for me. This caller admits to voting for Kyrsten Sinema previously and says she's ashamed for having done it. Take a listen.
Hi, David. This is Barb from Tucson, Arizona. And I am ashamed to say I personally voted for Kristen Sinema when she ran last time because she represented herself as being a Democrat, which she apparently is not. She's just an attention-getting brat stomping her feet. And I'll tell you this, I have personally contacted the county Democratic headquarters and requested that they start a recall petition. We need to get rid of her.
Yeah, you know, I appreciate the caller for being honest and being honest about her shame. I know Arizona has recalls for legislators. It has a mechanism. I can't tell from looking at it whether it only applies to state legislators or whether it would apply to a representative in D.C. like Kyrsten Sinema. I don't see it as likely, and you know why. Sinema is still pretty popular in Arizona. I know there's a lot about she's just horrible and everybody hates her. Federally, she's not very popular. In Arizona, those are the folks who get to vote. She's really not doing that poorly. And so I don't know whether that recall would work. But there are lots of folks like this caller who say, I did vote for her, but I wouldn't next time. And we'll see what the future holds for Kyrsten Sinema. We're going to talk on the bonus show today about major decisions upcoming for the Supreme Court on guns, on abortion, on death penalty, as the approval of the death penalty of the Supreme Court, rather, is lower than it's been in decades. We will also talk about Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's pouncing on Facebook and saying break Facebook up in the wake of the major outage that took place yesterday, which affected Facebook as well as Instagram and WhatsApp, which we talked about at the top of the show. And we will talk about Lars Vilks, the Muhammad cartoonist from 2007. He has died in a car accident. We will talk and review the entire Muhammad cartoon story. All of those stories on today's bonus show. Get instant access by signing up at JoinPacman.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Hi, this is Felicia Collins from Late Show with David Letterman, and you are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
We are Microwaves, reminding you that the most important things in life are to crush your enemies,
to see them driven before you,
and to hear the lamentations of their women while listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
You're tuned to WRCT Pittsburgh's automated...
Soon, pay toilets will take over the world, and everyone, everywhere will listen to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Hey, this is Marlon Saunders, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song word.
From New York, Rock Raider.
Yeah, yeah, 1-2, Total Eclipse.
From Executioners, and we chilling on WRCT.
Word up, Pittsburgh representing 88.3 FM.
Check it out,
dial. Aight, peace.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
WRCT. WRCT.
Soul is next.
We don't actually have the legal documentation to back that up.
Hey, this is Ben Foles, and you're listening to WRCT. It's 2 for Tuesday, 3 for Thursday, Ladies Night Wet T-Shirt Contest on 88.3 FM, biatch.
Thank you.
Hovland, you're listening to 88.3 WRCT FM, Pittsburgh.
Pigsburg.
Now, it's E. Dueto from the Love Dogs, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
WRCT, Pittsburgh. Yeah, that's where things like this go, right down the drain.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I joined Facebook because I think Facebook has the potential to bring out the best in us. But I'm here today because I believe Facebook's products harm children, stoke division, and weaken our democracy.
Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen testifies before the Senate, accusing the social media giant of prioritizing profit over the safety of its billions of users. Will our highlights and get response. Then to California to look at this weekend's devastating oil spill and the renewed calls to ban offshore oil drilling. Finally, becoming abolitionists, police, protests, and the pursuit of freedom. We'll speak with human rights attorney, activist, and author Derricka Purnell.
For a generation of new black activists, right, our calls to dismantle or to abolish the prison industrial complex didn't come from ignorance or dismissal or because we just had enough. That was not our entry into this work. It's quite the contrary. We spent more than a decade organizing within the confines of the criminal legal system.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen gave explosive testimony before a Senate subcommittee Tuesday denouncing the social media giant for prioritizing astronomical profits over the safety of billions of users. Haugen's testimony gave a rare glimpse into the secretive tech company, which she accused of harming children, sowing division by boosting hateful content and undermining democracy. Haugen urged lawmakers to enact strict oversight over Facebook before it's too late. This is Frances Haugen.
Facebook wants you to believe that the problems we're talking about are unsolvable. They want you to believe in false choices. They want you to believe that you must choose between a Facebook full of divisive and extreme content or losing one of the most important values our country was founded upon, free speech. That you must choose between public oversight of Facebook's choices and your personal privacy. That to be able to share fun photos of your kids with old friends, you must also be inundated with anger-driven virality. They want you to believe that this is just part of the deal. I am here today to tell you that's not true.
Frances Haugen's testimony comes after she leaked tens of thousands of pages of internal Facebook documents. We'll have more on this story after headlines. The Senate's expected to vote on a procedural step that would bring a suspension of the debt ceiling to a floor vote, even as Republicans insist they won't support the move. Minority Leader Mitch McConnell told President Biden earlier this week Democrats would have to pass the bill through reconciliation, even though Republicans could allow the measure to pass with a simple majority. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer blasted Republicans what he called irresponsibility.
We can stop this Republican-manufactured debt ceiling crisis in its tracks, or Republicans can keep driving our country ever closer to the first default in American history.
On Tuesday, President Biden said Democrats could move to reform filibuster rules to bypass the Republican blockade on the debt limit, though conservative Democrats Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin have previously voiced their opposition to filibuster changes. According to research by ProPublica, the national debt rose by $7.8 trillion to $28 trillion, due in large part to Republicans and then-President Trump's 2017 tax cuts for corporations and the ultra-rich. Constituents of Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema are stepping up pressure on the corporate Democrat as she continues to threaten passage of the sweeping reconciliation package that would expand the nation's social safety net and combat the climate emergency. On Monday, Corina Ruiz, head of the Arizona DREAM Act Coalition and a former volunteer on the Sinema campaign, approached the Senate.